Welcome to Crosspoint.
Welcome to Crosspoint.
Welcome to Crosspoint.
We are an inclusive faith community
seeking to live out the loving, just, and generous way of Jesus.
We are participants in a long tradition
that's less concerned with doctrines and dogma that demand total agreement,
but a life to be lived, enjoyed, and given away to others.
What unites us is a growing awareness that life is precious,
that we are made by love in order to love.
This community is comprised of and affirms the entire human family,
regardless of race, age, creed,
physical abilities, marital or economic status,
gender identity, or sexual orientation.
So, if you are curious and have come to see,
if you are tired and have come to rest,
if you are grateful and have come to share,
if you are wounded and have come to heal,
if you are joyful and have come to celebrate,
if you are uprooted and have come to belong,
welcome home.
Welcome home.
Welcome home.
Welcome home.
Good morning, everybody. We're going to continue our series, Heart Knower. And today we're going to talk about anger. So let's start off on a light foot, shall we? Jesus said, "You have heard that it was said to people long ago, 'You shall not murder,' and 'Anyone who murders will be subject to judgment.' But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister without cause is subject to judgment." Again, anyone who says to a brother or sister, "Raka," this is an old Aramaic slur or insult, that person is answerable to the court. And anyone who says, "You fool," is subject to the fires of the Valley of Hinnom. For Jesus, and for the way of Jesus, anger is pretty clearly a problem. And, my dear friends, we have an anger problem. And then we also have an understanding what anger even is problem. A couple days ago, I was watching clips of news and commentary and even some comedy shows from 2013. And I was confronted with a really sobering reminder. These clips presented person after person, leader after leader, citizen after citizen, very angrily. They were angry, full of contempt for other people, enraged. They're angry about the president. They were angry about people that were angry about the president. People were angry about climate change. They were angry about Iraq. They were angry about Ferguson. They were angry about race. They were angry about how freedom was disappearing. They were angry about religion and what was happening to religion and happening because of religion. They were angry about government spending. They were angry about social media. They were angry about immigration. And who knows how many things in their personal lives they were angry about. Here's the thing. It sounded like it was clips from the last 8 days, not from 8 years ago. And every one of those topics that I mentioned is nuanced and really important. Every one of them. And I'm far from neutral about most of them. But this is what was sobering. What have we gotten for all of our anger and our justifications about being angry? If a society or a nation has something like a soul collectively, then what might be the health of a nation's soul when it has clearly been in sustained anger for years and, frankly, decades? What happens to our individual and collective hearts when we're angry all the time? I'd wager, with the backing of science and ancient wisdom, that what happens to our hearts isn't good at all. But, listen, anger is normal. It's natural. It can even be useful. So how can we shame something that arises naturally in response to the world around us? Because it's safe to assume most of us gathered in this moment aren't monsters. And frankly, aren't there some issues that just need our intensity behind them? And maybe even more frankly, aren't there some people who really do need to be told off, who need to be confronted? Maybe they're in your present, but maybe they're in your past. Maybe they're on TV. It doesn't matter. That anger energy is still there, inviting itself to be used. Aren't there some people you'd love to grab by the collar and just and just really let them have it. So they couldn't be mean, so they couldn't be willfully stupid or untrustworthy, or they just couldn't be that anymore. Aren't there some powerful people, well-loved powerful people, who you know darn well they're not so great even though everybody else seems to be under their spell? Wouldn't you just love, if only once, to just mop the floor with them in front of everybody? Or maybe that's too direct. Maybe you don't like to be that direct. Maybe you're the type that you'd love to see somebody else do it to them. Your anger never boils up that way. If it shows up, it stays under the surface a little bit, but it's still hate, it's disgust, it's cheering against them. And look, before we shrink away from this, admit it, name it, most of us can find some way to agree that sometimes the intensity of anger, it wants to come out, and when it comes out, it feels good. We know exactly where we'd like to aim that anger, and at who, because it boils up inside of us with no place to go. It's like a pressure, it's like a heat. We look around at the world, or a classroom, or the office, and we can feel anger about so many things that we've just had enough of. You know what I'm talking about. It's primal. It's visceral. This ocean of energy that wants to be made manifest in the real world outside of ourselves. And to not let it out, it feels wrong. And it comes on stronger. And it comes on stronger still. And it just wants to be expressed. It wants to come out. It wants to come out of your hands. It wants to come out of your mouth as recklessly as it needs to be. It wants to set the record straight once and for all. It wants to take no more crap. It wants to shut others up once and for all. You know what it wants? It wants control. It wants to kick things over. It wants to knock things down. It wants to see the right people put down to size. The seething, dammed up pressure that must find its way out of us. It's not carefully considered words. It's power. It just wants to pour out this intense, disgusted, final power until we just say we've carried it long enough. Now the world has to carry it. I'm not going to keep this inside for one more moment. Give me fuel. Give me fire. Give me that which I desire. Maybe you know, maybe you don't know. In the Bible, there's this guy named Cain, and he gets really angry, so he kills his brother. There's another guy named Balaam. He got angry, and he abused an animal. Haman got angry at Mordecai for not bowing down to him, so he vowed to kill him and all Jews. Esau got angry at his brother Jacob, so he vowed to murder him and hunted him for years. Peter, St. Peter, got angry once, more than once, right in front of Jesus, and he tried to cut a guy's head off with a sword. Jesus once preached a sermon to an audience that they didn't care for that sermon, so they got angry and they tried to throw Jesus off of a cliff. In the Bible, the vast, vast majority of the time, someone gets angry, and what follows is suffering. Someone gets angry about something happening in a way that they did not want it to go, and they get angry. And when they get angry, they cause more suffering. This thing that wants to be expressed out in the world, it feels right, it feels good, it maybe even comes with good reasons, and yet it's far more prone to cause destruction and suffering than it is ever to improve anything. Oftentimes, it's aggressive violence. Oftentimes, it's just a roiling hate. Either way, it multiplies suffering in ourselves and others far more than it reduces suffering. Which highlights an important point. If we're people participating in ancient wisdom like the Bible and are trying to grow in wisdom by studying those scriptures, nowhere in any of the books of the Bible do we see anger celebrated as a virtue. Nowhere does it say, he was an angry man and therefore a saint. Much the opposite. The anger of human beings does not produce the righteousness of God, the brother of Jesus said. Refrain from anger. Forsake wrath. Upset not yourself. It tends only to evil, said the psalmist. Whoever is slow to anger has great understanding. But he who has hasty temper exalts folly. Or the other proverb that reads, make no friendship with a man given to anger, nor go with a wrathful man. Or perhaps consider this list of values Paul shares that we've probably gotten the reputation for bringing up about every three Sundays. Paul says, the fruit of the Spirit, the evidence that the Spirit is at play in your life is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. There is no law against such things. If anger is so good, and maybe not other people's anger, but my anger, because I'm angry for good reason, remember. If anger is so good, then why isn't it on this list? Why isn't it even implied? How can something so intense and so real and sometimes so satisfying not be what it means to be in step with the power of Christ's transforming spirit? Because stuff needs transformed. Well, it's interesting, I think, how the next sentence goes. We don't often quote the next part, where he says, the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, and peace, and patience, and kindness, and goodness, and faithfulness, and gentleness, and self-control. There is no law against such things. And those who belong to Christ Jesus have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires. Powerful and even tricky imagery here. The way of Christ puts to death the way of the flesh. For Paul, this isn't an indictment against our bodies when he says flesh, although it gets used that way a lot. This is a way of talking about uncontrolled impulse, the animal instinct. The evidence of the Spirit is described by words like love and joy and gentleness and then self-control, which is a shocking thing. You'd think if you're led by the Spirit, that would mean that you're Spirit-controlled. But no, if you're led by the Spirit, you're self-controlled. It means that you've done the gentle self and others loving work of bringing yourself under your own mastery, no longer sustaining and nurturing the out-of-control mammal, but bringing its desires and its passions, its raging sufferings, under our own compassionate control. Not deleting them, as the metaphor of crucifying the flesh might imply. We're not getting rid of them. It's not suppression. That just causes more trouble. And it invalidates a lot of really strong feelings about important issues. It's gaining real, peaceful, wise mastery over the self. Offering them up to die, the flesh, to be resurrected as something more, something eternal, something reborn. And so I want to admit to you something very personal. I am angry a lot. I get so frustrated. I can become so disgusted, so furious sometimes, so full of contempt that for all my desire for this not to be the case, I can become full-on self-righteous. And so I come to you today not as one who's mastered this part of myself, and I could try to draw a pat on the back out of you by telling you that it's better compared to how it used to be, and it is. But suffice it to say that though it is better, I have a long road ahead of me where anger and frustration and even contempt are concerned. And here is what has helped and is helping. Understanding that anger is a natural reaction. It's a primary emotion. Which means it just arises in the face of external situations. You see a kid shoved by an adult. You see a person steal from somebody else. You find out that you've been manipulated or lied to or taken advantage of despite pouring yourself out in good faith. Anger is a primary emotion. It just happens as an automatic internal reaction to external circumstances. It's completely natural. In fact, I think God made us this way. And there are other primary emotions too, like sadness. Sadness is a primary emotion. Suffering loss causes sadness without our having to choose to be sad. It's a primary emotional response to suffering loss. But what often happens, and the reason this message exists, is the primary emotion becomes a secondary emotion. And secondary emotions are generally not helpful. A secondary emotion is when you feel something about the feeling. Like you suffer loss, you feel sadness about that loss, you feel afraid, but then you get angry because that something or that someone made you feel sad or afraid. You're primarily grieving loss, but now secondarily you're angry that you have been made to suffer that grief. And the secondary emotion is longer lasting and often way more intense. And it's way less helpful because it's often obscuring what's actually going on. It disguises the truth of what's going on inside of us. When we get stuck in anger, or make a habit of going to it without understanding what's actually going on underneath, it turns this emotional data into directions for our behavior. It turns information into instructions. And we get trapped. We become at the mercy of the intensity of our anger, our rage-filled feelings, without ever looking underneath them. And this is when anger goes from something normal and maybe even useful into something that causes many of our worst problems as human beings. It forces the higher part of ourselves, our logic, our reasoning, our understanding, our compassion, it forces all that into service to the lower part of ourselves that just wants to knock things down, wants to lash out and destroy in this unthinking mammalian attempt to neutralize the outside world so it can't hurt us. Have you noticed how much of what comes across the screens on our walls or the screens in our pockets? Have you noticed how much of what's on those screens is designed to keep us in this state? Agitated and angry, unthinking and aggressive? Have you noticed it sometimes feels like an addiction to go get that angry hit, that disgusted visceral intensities toward something or someone? You know, click on this link and enjoy a good seethe. You can make billions of dollars keeping us this way. And the real trick is that our brains actually reward our aggressions and our angry intensity with pleasure chemicals in our brain. It literally feels good to get this hit of anger and aggression, despite it doing ourselves and our world long-term harm, which should sound just like an addiction. We have an anger problem in the sense that we have an anger addiction, many of us, and it's going to be the end of many of us, just like an addiction. And so perhaps it's going to be as helpful for you as it has been for me to get honest about primary things. Yes, we have an anger problem. We do. But over the course of a couple decades of ministry, I can tell you confidently that really, we have another problem entirely. We're sad. We're sad and we don't realize it. We're afraid and we won't know it. We have buried the primary emotion of grief, the sadness of all that we lost in our younger years, of having our wonderful, vulnerable ideas of childhood stripped from us one thing at a time, the sadness over loss that we all feel in some measure. We've got it all wrapped in the secondary emotion of anger, of rage, of contempt, of hate. And we've buried the primary emotion of fear, that anxiety that comes from coming to understand that the world didn't turn out to be as safe as it could have been for some of us, that our caretakers didn't take very good care, that friends and family and animals and viruses and nations and maybe who we thought was God can turn out to be untrustworthy, even cruel. And that fear became an abiding anger, a disdain, a contempt, and a rage. We're suffering. We're all, to one degree or another, we're suffering. I couldn't help but notice as we watched people commit those awful things at the Capitol in January. Over and over, I saw them, or I read about them, defending their actions. Why did they do it? Almost every single one of them, in one way or another, said, because we're angry. And I noticed myself and others, as we witnessed what they did and their disregard and the rationale, and as we observed it, we were angry. And I saw how our anger feels right. Theirs, though, seems misguided and demented. And maybe that's right. Maybe that is the case in this specific example. But when I was also told about an entirely different issue, and I was told that if I wasn't angry about it, then I wasn't paying attention. And I wanted to say to that, I am paying attention, but I'm also angry about all these other things. Be angry. Don't be angry. This anger is good. That's not bad. And somewhere in all of this, Jesus' brother keeps repeating in the air, I know, dear siblings, slow down and recall that the anger of human beings doesn't produce the righteousness of God. Do you even notice that everyone's angry and renewal still isn't coming? Do you notice everyone is justifying their anger, but no one is looking underneath that anger? Don't you notice that in our relationships, in our citizenship, in our moving for causes that matter, we keep trying to make anger a fruit, and then we can't understand that why everything around us that's growing just looks like more pain? If we refuse to meaningfully address that many of us are living entire eras of our lives in perpetual self-justifying anger and chronic rage, then we might be allowing our existence to fuel problems and suffering just as much as those we're angry at. And so, listen to just Jesus again. You have heard that it was said to people long ago, you shall not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister without cause is subject to judgment. Now, you might be tempted to see this word judgment and think of judgment day or a courtroom where God is, you know, behind the bench and your anger is being sentenced along with all your other crimes and with the crimes of the murderer. But listen to me. Let's cut through these pictures, these metaphors. There's a reason Jesus speaks here of judgment. But that reason isn't simply that your anger will be counted against you in a court of divine law. Remember what you already know to be the case. We are judged by our sins far more than we are judged for our sins. Our constant anger is judged by the very fact of it tearing our bodies apart, by it focusing our minds exclusively on what's wrong at the expense of all that's good. Our anger is judged out in the open for what it does to relationships and members of our own families, our churches, our communities, our nation. Our anger is subject to judgment because it takes a beautiful God-given existence and restricts it to a constant, oppositional, tight-chested hell. And in case the way I'm putting that sounds too poetic or theoretical, quarantine has held couples in each other's presence at home far more than usual, which has caused many stresses. Not least of those stresses would be men who've not processed their own sense of loss and anxiety and who have become violent aggressors toward their partners. Their anger, their secondary emotion of anger, has metastasized, and their stubborn refusal to deal with their own suffering has caused them to be the source of some of the very worst suffering there is, domestic violence. To which I would say to the victims in that situation, let us know how we can help. We absolutely will make sure you and any children there might be get the support and the distance that you need. We know that this is a reality, and we know that it's become more of a problem in this last year. And to the abuser in that situation, I would say, let us know if you're ready to get help so that you can help your partner and any children there may be get the support and the distance that they need. And then maybe you could get some help learning that your anger has overtaken you because you haven't learned that love and kindness and gentleness and self-control are on the same list for a reason. And that though there might be consequences for your treatment of those you said you love, you can choose to wake up and not live the rest of your life being a source of pain for other people. So sincerely, if anger has come to this in your home, we're here to help, as are professionals trained to address this expertly. So you can make use of the numbers below if I've described anyone in your home or someone close to you that you love. And while this is an extreme example of the ruin anger does when we allow it to metastasize from data for us to acknowledge to directions on how we are now going to behave ruinously in the world, anger is always an emotion loaded with a choice. It's always a choice between poison or fruit. And that's why the story from Mark chapter 3 is amazing. It says, Jesus went into a synagogue. A man with a crippled hand was there. Some people watched Jesus closely to see if he would heal the man on the Sabbath day, the day of rest, so they could accuse him of, you know, doing work, even good work, on the day of rest. So Jesus said to the man with the crippled hand, stand up here in the middle of everyone. Then Jesus asked the people, which is lawful on the Sabbath day, to do good or to do evil, to save a life or to kill? Which is a brilliant question. But they said nothing to answer him. Jesus was angry as he looked at the people. And he felt very sad because they were stubborn. Then he said to the man, "Hold out your hand." And the man held out his hand, and it was healed. Then the Pharisees left and began making plans with the Herodians about a way to kill Jesus. The anger of human beings doesn't achieve God's righteousness, but the anger of Christ is a well-understood anger. And so the anger of Christ is something seen as secondary, and so then he gets to its root, what's primary, and it was sadness over their stubbornness, what's happened to their hearts over these people who allegedly represent God. There was actually grief underneath the anger, and he channels this insight away from ruin and toward goodness and restoration, and his anger becomes healing. And the others, of course, they just get angry. And what do? They began planning Jesus' murder. Do you see the distinction? Do you see the choice? The self-control resulting in more love, more goodness, more righteousness in the world. It's a choice. And so I'm going to wrap this up with a few helpful things I hope we'll lean into immediately. One, we often talk about slowing down, because when you slow down, you are, generally speaking, more aware. But I think what some of us hear is slow down means, because you're always going fast, sometimes go slow. And then when you're done going slow, go fast again. And please understand, slow down and stay slowed down. What do I mean? Slowing down helps us recognize in real time that the angry intensity that is raising up in us is most often a secondary emotion. Slowing down helps us see that in real time. To say, I'm getting angry, but primarily I think I'm embarrassed. I think I wanted that person to compliment me, and they didn't. Because I have a lifelong insecurity about my worth. And it grieves me. More than angers me, it grieves me because it makes me feel unworthy. And I always go right from grief to anger, but I'm actually sad because once again, I have that feeling of unworth, and that makes me defensive. Or slowing down and staying slow, it can help you see that you're trapped in like this aggravated confirmation bias, where I tend to see the world through a particular lens that I always use. I tend to hear others, even those close to me, and the news, and I hear sermons, I hear compliments and criticisms and requests and complaints. If I slow down, I realize I always hear those things in a way that reinforce beliefs I already have and that I'm already angry about. Slowing down helps me to see that my bias is in play. And so if I slow down, I can stay open and not upset myself because I'm not going to immediately tell myself the same story I always tell myself. I'm going to stay open so I can actually comprehend what's going on. This is huge. You ever notice that when we're angry, we say or even yell things like, "I don't understand why you would," or "Who do you think you are?" Or "What were you thinking?" You hear these questions that we bark out? What is that supposed to mean? You ever notice that? We become real inquisitive when we're angry. Now, those are rhetorical questions. But what if they weren't rhetorical? What if you slowed down and realized, I'm sort of rhetorically admitting that I don't understand? Because it's hard to be angry when you have understanding. I would say they're often, most often, maybe always, mutually exclusive, anger and understanding. Slow down, and rather than asking questions that you don't really want an answer for, actually ask them. "I don't understand. Could you help me understand? What do you believe about yourself and me? I don't understand. What is your thinking on this, and how did you arrive at this thinking? Because I came out on a totally different line of thinking. What does what you just said, what does that mean? Because I'm tempted to take it the wrong way, but I want to slow down and understand." You can only do this if you slow down and stay slowed down. The fruit of the Spirit is slow grown. Fast food isn't good for anyone. Slow down. Here's another thing. Pay attention to your body and your feelings. This is true for all of us, and maybe it's especially true for the children in our care. We have to normalize self-control as a way of describing awareness of our body and our feelings. The anger and the tension and the aggression that we feel, it's visceral. That energy has to go somewhere. So if we're not aware of our bodies, if we're not moving regularly, we don't eat mindfully, that energy just has fewer places to go. That intensity has to go somewhere. And so it oftentimes will go in a place we don't want it to go. So I really do hope you're noticing by now, all spiritual development not only includes, but it centers awareness of and the healthy habits of the body. And again, this is true for adults and children. Counting to 10 actually works. Mom was right. Because that's about as much time as a triggered amygdala needs to stand down. This is simple emotional and bodily awareness, a technique that actually works when you're feeling anger, to slow down and count to 10, paying attention to our sensations, 4 or 5 cleansing breaths. Count to 10. It puts us back in touch with reality and detaches us from the stories we always tell ourselves that keep us in fight or flight. And so this should be a regular part of our day, especially if anger is something we get tripped up on a lot. Breathe and slow the tape, checking in with your body and your feelings. How am I doing? Taking routine walks or runs, trampolining, lift weights, climb a tree, slam a bouncy ball down on the road as hard as you can to see how high it bounces. Go throw a frisbee. I'll let you decide which of these are for the adults and which are for the kids. It doesn't matter. Our bodies will use up a lot of the energy that might otherwise try to become something destructive. We have to become aware of our bodies, get in our bodies, become aware of how we're actually feeling in a given moment. Here's another. Apologize often. We've been angry for a long time, so that's the whole tip. Apologize often. To wake up and to repent of our anger, at how the world is and how we've moved through it, we're going to have to become really gracious with ourselves and with others, and to recognize that our anger has been really, really messy, that we've had a pattern of raka. So we have to apologize specifically and often about how we're going to do better next time. If you're taking this work seriously, you're going to do a lot of apologizing, and they might not forgive you. We're not owed forgiveness when we apologize. And pay attention, that might make you angry. You might say, well, that's not right. Now my anger is justified. Listen, now you've got a great teaching. Now rather than get angry because things didn't go how you planned, they didn't do their job by forgiving you, now you've got a great teacher where you can understand patience and peace in the face of contrary circumstances. Apologize often. One more thing, despite there being so many of these, assume suffering, because we don't. Part of why we get so angry is I think we assume others aren't suffering and are being generally intentionally bad actors. Assume suffering. Every moment of every day, every interaction, assume suffering. This is unlike all other assumptions, you'll be right every single time. Suffering is universal. It's everywhere. It's part of human life. There is so much loss. Now maybe more than ever, there are so many things. There's so many things in the future that are unclear and unsure and maybe motivate people to put their shields up. Does it to me sometimes. If we choose to see the world as, yes, full of beauty and awe, it's unbelievable, but also full of suffering, of human beings who are trying their best to figure out how to lessen their own suffering with the only tools they know how to use. If you begin to see the world that way, you will be an agent of peace. To assume suffering is almost automatically to be an agent of kindness. You will be love. Now, will you be vulnerable? Yes. I'm sorry, there's no other way. And perhaps now's not the time for you specifically to become vulnerable. That's a genuine consideration. But for the rest of us, the vast majority of us, this is the only way. The crucified Christ says, follow me. Follow me. Vulnerability is the path. There's pain and love. There's pain and kindness. There's vulnerability in putting down our anger and trade for understanding. There's pain in putting down our demand for things to be a certain way and trade for acceptance and kindness towards people as they are. And we will, along the way, often be angry. But we'll also be aware that more and more people are grieving, they're afraid, and that we're just as capable of being joyful and creative and at peace as we have been with anger. It was true then, in Jesus' day, it's true now. This is what restores hands. This is what raises life from death. This is another way we can begin to heal and the world around us heal in the bargain. Peace to us.
If you would like to know more or get connected to Crosspoint, go to crosspoint.org. If you're in need of care or assistance, go to crosspoint.org/care. And welcome home.